This is the October 15th, 2015 climate change law class. Usual format, looking back. Any questions about our last class discussion on Thursday about international trade, restrictions on trade and the World Trade Organization treaty system and how those are affected by climate change policies? Okay. I am still striving to get a copy of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. The hope is that next Friday, there's a meeting of the National Advisory Committee to NAFTA at EPA. And if all goes well, we may get at least a rough draft of basic core principles of it distributed at that conference. And if so, I'll share it because it clearly is going to be an important steering influence on United States, Canada, and Mexican climate change policy to the extent that they are embodied in trade actions. But other than that, really, everyone feels cool with it. That gives me an enormous sense of confidence. Okay, then today we're in a transition. And to a certain extent, this is an arc you guys hopefully have had a sense to get a feel of as we've moved along, which is we've started globally and factually. We've now gone through the international legal system in general. We've now also done the treaty system in particular. We are now going to keep stepping down to more local measures. Next week, we actually begin our deep dive into U.S. law. But for this stop, we're actually going to do a comparative discussion on other nations' climate change policies so that we have a backdrop to measure the sufficiency or what is the unique exceptional aspects of U.S. climate law. So today we're going to talk about really three nations: Canada, China, and Brazil. I will exercise a little bit of professor's prerogative and try and tack on a little bit of a discussion about India at the end, simply because it's so fascinating and it's something which I think actually could be more important than China in the relatively near future. And my hope is that we can sort of get a sense of a spectrum of different approaches, where each of these nations fall in that spectrum and where the United States stands in regard to them. So to do that, let me just paint a few broad strokes to begin the discussion. But then what I'm going to do is ask you to start fermenting in the back of your heads the fundamental question of, now that you've read the materials for today and you have a sense of what the general approaches of Canada, China, and Brazil basically are, which one seems to have the most appropriate policy given their circumstances and tools that they've selected to be as a strategy to respond to climate change. Big picture, first of all, you may have noticed reading the materials, and this is why we are not using Professor Osofsky's book, which is very good in lots of ways, but it's sadly out of date. I mean, hopefully some of you are reading that and going, what? The data goes, some of the information is from 2005, and trends have really surpassed them. So the big things I want us to remind ourselves of that we talked about in class: number one, China is the world's leading emitter of greenhouse gases by a substantial margin above the United States. Number two, the nations with the most significant growth in greenhouse gas emissions are now the developing nations, the non-Annex II nations. And that if you combine their current emissions, the developing nations now emit more than the developed nations collectively. Again, substantially. But third, and again, this hopefully is all deeply familiar to you, per capita emissions are still far higher in the industrialized world. And historically, the accumulated greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are vastly and disproportionately attributable to historical activities by the industrialized nations. So with those key drivers, let's start thinking about how not international law should respond, but how each of these nations should play the cards that they're dealt. Just very briefly, because the reading load was already a little inhumane, I did not ask you to look at the European Union. But in part, I think we've captured some of the European Union in our discussion about Kyoto. Let me throw out a little bit about the European Union, then we'll start talking about each of the nations for today. First of all, the key thing about the European Union is that it's not a nation. It's actually a supranational organization consisting of the members of the EU, which currently are 27 member states. It's governed by a European Council, it has its own European Parliament, and it has a European Commission that functions as an executive branch. So to a certain extent, there are echoes of the US political division of authorities and powers. And here's why I'm mentioning the EU. I think the general consensus, even with actions taken by the Obama administration, is that the European Union has been much more aggressive in responding to climate change as a matter of national policy. There are some who argue that basically the European Union has lapped the field and has left the United States substantially behind in terms of being a leader in crafting effective climate policy on a national level, for them, supranational. They have been much more aggressive, you may recall, in terms of actually implementing Kyoto. They are the only ones that signed up for a second commitment period of the industrialized world with a significant reduction for Kyoto. They're the ones who have actually ratified other environmental treaties, including the Convention on Biological Diversity and the Basel Convention on Transborder Hazardous Waste, which we haven't talked about in this class, but basically, again, the United States either signed or failed to even sign to participate in. And they've been actually integrating the precautionary principle as a matter of national law embodied in EU directives, and it's actually written into their Treaty of the European Union. So, as a result, their reductions arguably are more impressive. The United States has maybe reduced more in terms of absolute tonnage, but our reductions seem to be more key to economic developments independent of our policy, namely the development of shale gas and unconventional resources. So, two questions I'll throw out. One, why the European Union and not the United States? What is it that is about the EU that's made them a climate leader when in most other respects they seem to be playing the same type of cards the United States has been dealt? And second, you know, to a certain extent, the EU benefits from outsourcing its greenhouse gases. Essentially about 40% of their carbon could be attributed to goods that they've actually exported for production at other facilities, other nations. So to what extent is it fair to point to the EU as a climate leader when effectively they're pushing their consumed carbon to other locations? With that in mind, I'll pause. I just wanted to bless you.
Thank you.
Very high level in terms of the EU. That seems to be, if we had our spectrum, what I would peg as the most active of the nations as a matter of domestic policy in terms of crafting climate change reviews. So now let's start working our way through the rest. The United States, ironically, we're just going to put a little bit of a pause on. That's going to be the topic for discussion for about the next 6 weeks. So I think we know a little bit about their perspective from the national level based on their representations to the UNFCCC. But focusing on just the nations we have today, if we were going to have a spectrum in terms of, let's just say, proactiveness to respond to climate change policies. Before we get into our discussion, just a quick sampling of the field. If I put EU on one end as most, where would you put Brazil, China, and Canada? Well, there's no right or wrong answer here. This is more a sense of what your gut's telling you based on our meetings.
Maybe I put Brazil farthest in.
As the most reactive?
Yeah.
Not proactive, but least proactive. Okay. I'll come back and ask you why. Okay, then less active than Brazil, less active than China.
Maybe China can be down there too.
This is going to be a dark class, like, I can tell already.
Overtly has made more signs that it's willing to make climate changes. Like, whether or not it's true, I mean, it seems like they've made more.
Okay, so China is a little bit above Brazil. And does anyone object to this? Europe is like India, not China, in our exercise, right? So who's representing China?
I was representing Brazil, but I would respectfully disagree. Very
respectfully. You would know more than me. Go ahead.
I think that the measures that Brazil's taken with preventing deforestation, and they made huge gains, I think, in cutting down on that, and mm-hmm. have, I think they've done a lot, and I think China has made some strides, but I'd probably put China behind Brazil.
So you would actually put them like somewhere here in the middle?
Yeah, I'd put Canada and Brazil somewhere in the middle. I don't know how I'd rank the two.
Okay.
But I'd put China at the end, I think.
All right, so a little bit of discussion about Brazil then. This would be interesting. So that sort of leaves the one we haven't put up here yet. Where does Canada fit on this scale? Our neighbor, the one who's sort of the closest analog in many ways to the United States. I know, we can't do it too Malou, I'm sorry. Would anyone put it close to the EU? I mean, they did sign and ratify the Kyoto Accords protocol, excuse me. Or here, because they repudiated the Kyoto Protocols and refused to do the second commitment period?
For that reason, I'd want it closer to the middle, I think.
Okay. Or over here, because, well, let's just say Keystone XL is a sort of marker for a much larger discussion. Or if I feel like my hand is gravitating like a Ouija board. Okay, well, how about this? I'll just sort of do another bracket. If Brazil's got a wide range, with Nick over at this end, and Caroline saying it's the worst of the worst. That means then for Canada, somewhere in a narrow range, but are centered on the same point. Is that about right? Okay, so now looking around the room, last chance to hit the eject button. Does anyone sort of view we've really missed the point with these sort of rough assignments of proactivity, which of course is a non-legal concept, but just, I think, a fair reflection of values that we're trying to accomplish with the law. All right, so everyone's okay with that. I'm looking at Joey because he was such a vigorous debater in our last,
Just, you know, I just want to calm things down.
All right, I can't resist asking, where would India fit on this scale for you?
Up by Brazil.
Really?
Yeah,
I'd like me to extend the scale a little further this way.
They're not terrible, but they're not doing a whole lot. They want to do a lot.
Okay. All right. Well, if that's the case then, what I'd like to do is start working our way. It's kind of sad that, one, for those listening in on the recorder, our spectrum is entirely empty on the left-hand proactive side except for the EU. So apparently, most of those we're talking about today are basically doing a half job, sounds like at best. Number two, there's no strict correlation between who's the most developed and who isn't, who's the poorest and who isn't. It seems to be that you're gauging the proactivity based on the mix of policies they put on the table coming from where they're at, what resources they have, what priorities they have. So with that in mind, sort of drill down a little bit on that. Why don't we go ahead and start with Canada, since it seems to kind of be gravitating, but subject to some debate, towards the middle. Why would y'all, I'll be honest, if I'd asked this question 10 years ago or 20 years ago, Canada by default would be over here. What is it about Canada's position that's made you push it farther towards the end with the bad faith actors? What is it that Canada's doing?
To repudiating the Kyoto one and then not committing to the second part of Kyoto?
Well, let's absolutely, that's what they've done at the international level. But we're also talking about what they're doing domestically as well. So, by the way, I've handed Nick, and we'll just work around the table. And if y'all are interested, I can put it on the website as well. The materials in the book are out of date. The most recent snapshot of what each nation's climate change laws and policies are actually their independently nationally determined contribution statements that they filed in preparation for Paris, which literally have been filed, some of them are being filed this week. So it's pretty current. That's Canada's position statement, which is about 4 pages. So with that in mind, basic background, is anyone here from Canada or spent time in Canada? Hannah is not here today, but no? All right, very obvious stuff. Canada, like the United States, has a representational democracy. Like the United States, has a federal government division of powers, and I will tell you the provinces wield a heck of a lot of weight in national discussions there. They also, nonetheless, are a, at least theoretically, subject to monarchical direction, but that's more in terms of, I won't say that's had a large influence on environmental policy. As a result, Canada has had to navigate a split where you might have the national, these markers are awful, the nationally elected party that's, again, it's a parliamentary system, so their prime minister is actually reflecting who holds a plurality in the parliament at the time, might have a consistent national position, but they're saddled with the obligation of trying to shepherd through the different provinces. So, offhand then, that means part of the reasons that Canada has had such a fractured approach to climate change in some respects is because they've had to navigate getting approval from one, some of their indigenous population in the form of First Nation. As opposed to the United States, where Native tribes do have treaty rights, there's actually a much greater investiture of sovereign authority in the First Nation tribes in Canada, where they actually have much greater property and direct governmental control over vast swaths of territory. So, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name. They actually have a new province that is one of the furthest north in the Arctic that is almost entirely going to be governed by the First Nation. It's a fascinating place. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it's when I flew to Montreal and I thought, wow, I'm here. I should go over to this new province and see what it's like because it has enormous mineral resources.
Is it Nunavut?
Nunavut.
Nunavut.
Thank you. Spencer, did you know that, or is that the miracle of Google?
I double-checked on Google, but that was like some random fact that I remembered from like junior year
awesome.
Geography.
It's beautiful. It's a fabulous place. It really is. But when I discovered that it was going to take longer to fly from Montreal to Nunavut than it took me to fly to Montreal from Houston, that's how far north we're talking about. And that's a one of the spectrum. The indigenous First Nation populations have been split. They're strongly in favor of economic development. They've also been, in their minds, one of the most strongly affected by climate change in the Canadian populations. But more importantly, some of the provinces have an outsized voice, in particular Alberta. Think of Alberta as the Texas of Canada. They have the vast majority of the mineral resources, in particular hydrocarbon resources. They have a certain mindset which will remind you of Texas. Has anyone been to Calgary by any chance? Joey? Mm-hmm. Is this part of the program or?
No, just
went up there?
Vacationing, seeing Banff and Jasper, and driving around Edmonton, Alberta, and then over to BC, all kinds of good stuff.
So when you were in Calgary, did you feel like you were in Houston to some extent?
Yeah.
Were you there during the Stampede by chance?
I don't think so.
They claim their Stampede's bigger than our Houston rodeo. Take that with a grain of salt. Anyway, point being, Alberta is heavily invested in developing hydrocarbon resources that would then be sold in an international market. That's why, to a certain extent, Canada has this strange duality in its climate change positions at the domestic level. You may have a national initiative that will be driven by the current prime minister and party in power, but this business perspective tends to be more stable. The state and regional interests tend to let to fluctuate less. There's one important exception to that. Alberta, for the first time in like 20 years, last year elected a liberal government on a regional level. And you would not believe the stink that that's been creating in Alberta politics. So stay tuned. No one's quite sure what's going to happen, but there's talk that the new government in Alberta is focused on things like carbon tax, which is a picture of Texas with the carbon tax. We'll get an idea how much of a change that might be. So moving a little bit deeper on here, for Alberta, what type of form is their hydrocarbons in?
Tar sands.
Could you explain a little bit?
I'll do my best. So it's like a very thick, heavy type of oil that requires special extraction techniques that create kind of unique environmental problems, and it has a heavy greenhouse gas footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And it's heavily linked to the Keystone pipeline debate here, because that's what we'd be bringing down in the Keystone pipeline.
One question, and this is, it may not be a fair question. What's the difference between oil sands and shale oil? What sort of thing we're developing in hydrofracking?
Let me think if I can answer that.
And the answer, that's not a fair question, Professor. It's a perfectly valid response.
It's not. So the stuff we're doing here is in tight rock formations that we need special technology like fracturing to get out, which we have to shoot chemicals and water down to fracture the rocks. Where tar sands, I think, is it more like akin to like open pit mining, because they have like tailing ponds, and there's, that really has nothing to do with fracturing. Mm-hmm. I guess the extraction technique is just different for how you have to get it out.
And y'all don't mind, I'll erase half of our spectrum here. But you're right in many respects, if I could embellish it a little bit.
Sure.
It's all in the rock. The differences are really driven not by policy, but driven by geology. The difference is with type formations that are approached with hydraulic fracturing, what you're really talking about is in rock. If you've had oil and gas with Professor Weaver, she's probably brought a sample into class. It looks like just a chunk of concrete. But if you zoom in on a microscopic level, which she's probably discussed with you, there are tiny pockets of gas and oil trapped within it. So the challenge is, it's there, it's embedded within the rock. The question is breaking it free. So you end up with hydraulic fracturing, where on the surface you just drill, directionally drill, and you get to the tight layer, and then you basically break it with explosives. When you break the rock, you inject some type of proppant, or water, and surfactants, and it allows that inherently entrained oil and gas to bubble free and then be washed back up. That is not tar sands, oil sands. Fundamentally different. What you're talking about there is hydrocarbon that is actually part of the chemical composition of the rock itself. It has to be chemically broken free. So the ways you do that are essentially either, one, you have to cook the rock to a high degree and essentially break the oil and gas and hydrocarbons free that way, or you have to chemically, through an extremely caustic reagent, break it free. So to get at, you can't do this. This doesn't do you any good. Breaking up shale and breaking up tar sands doesn't liberate those hydrocarbons. Instead, it depends on how deep the layer is. So picture a sloping mountainside. If your hydrocarbon, your oil sand, or sorry, tar sands layer is up here, the simplest solution is just mine it. Dig it out, just like coal. So you end up with, Nick's exactly right, vast open pit mining operations, which have an enormous impact on local water supplies and also on just the landscape itself. It looks like a strip mine. Once you get that out, you actually then bake or chemically treat the rocks and produce a material called bitumen, which is not petroleum. It's essentially a very dense, nearly solid hydrocarbon stream that actually has to be mixed with other types of diluting agents to be able to put into a pipeline and ship down. It has a very, very high carbon footprint, even compared to petroleum.
if you're down here, you might be able to mine this part of it. But the other way you might do it is actually in situ refining. You basically drill, go into the stream, the layer, and then inject superheated steam or chemicals to heat it underground, and then try and chemically treat it so you can break free the hydrocarbons and pump it back up. So what does that mean? It means, one, it takes a heck of a lot of energy to produce a barrel of bitumen compared to just pumping up petroleum. The energy rate of return is low. Number two, you're getting a lot more carbon for every barrel of bitumen. Number three, you're having an enormous impact, even compared to hydraulic fracturing in developing oil sands. And number four, if you spill bitumen, it acts differently than oil, petroleum. We're still learning about this, but recently we've had some bitumen spills in Yellowstone and other rivers in Wyoming. And as opposed to petroleum, which will flow to the top of the water, bitumen has a tendency, after a little bit, to sink to the bottom. And getting it out is just nightmarish. By the way, I'm not opposed to developing oil sands. I'm just sort of laying out, it's different. And on the plus side, Canada has an enormous amount of this stuff. They're already our largest source of imported petroleum, but they have more oil in Alberta than Saudi Arabia. I'm sorry, they're number two to Saudi Arabia, but it's pretty close. Huge amount of resources there if they could figure out how to unlock it. So as a result, you have to ask yourself to a certain extent, given the role of development of this type of energy resource, in a way, it's almost astonishing that Canada is this far to the middle of the spectrum. How do you craft a climate change domestic policy when one of your main economic drivers, one of your most important provinces, is inherently going to be disfavored by any regime you create, be it tax, be it cap and trade, be it any type of direct regulation? So the book discusses a little bit how the politics slosh back and forth. With that in mind, I think the key things are, and I'll just sort of take away for discussion so we can have in mind we talk about China and Brazil. Number one, Canada does have domestic climate change legislation and a specific policy. Number two, even though Canada withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol in terms of its second compliance period, it has submitted independent national determination, which does specify intents to reduce total tonnage of greenhouse gas emissions, not just intensity. It's a little bit vague on how it's going to accomplish that, although it does stress that Canada already relies fairly significantly on hydropower and other types of carbon-free power sources. So that's level one. Any questions about Canada or input on it, based on what y'all read in the book? Okay, so let's move our way down the spectrum. I'm not sure I'm being fair here between China and Canada, but they seem to be pretty equivalent based on our gut reactions. Why did y'all put China in the middle when, by all respects, it was China's refusal to accept any kind of emissions restrictions that torpedoed the United States' signing of Kyoto that essentially doomed it to partial success at best? What is it that China's been doing that sort of lets you give them the benefit of the doubt to certain extent?
Well, I mean, just recently they agreed to a cap and trade policy by 2017. And they also, I guess they also agreed to cap their total emissions by 2030.
Well, to peak emissions by 2030. So yeah, you're basing it on?
On just recent development.
On news, basically.
Yeah, just on recent.
Okay. Again, let's sort of return to our broad strokes, but now you're absolutely right in terms of recent developments. But let's sort of face some cold realities. Number one, China is the largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world now. Number two, China has not agreed to reduce emissions. All they've agreed to is in the future to have peak emissions, but that they're, until then, the curve of emissions from now to 2030 is drastic. So they essentially locked in substantial carbon increases until 2030. Number three, that commitment is in the form of a bilateral statement between the United States and China. It's not implemented in any terms of Chinese law at this point. So I'm just sort of operating a counterbalance here. And number four, to a certain extent, China's ability to reduce its CO2 emissions through a centralized directive is less than what it used to be. I'll simply, and your book talks about this a little bit as well, but remember the discussion about the fact that the Chinese government is unitary, and that despite the presence of the People's Congress, it's really the Communist Party Politburo that effectively dictates policy. In days of Mao, obviously, that was very overwhelmingly effective method of control to dictate what happened at local levels. Because of economic development, now essentially a substantial autonomy at the local level. So essentially we're in a position where the ability of the president of China, or the prime minister, to point a finger and say thou shalt may not translate into action the same way it was able to previously. So all the way of saying, you're absolutely right. China stepped to the table in a major new way that it has not done before. But that means they hadn't been doing anything to step up prior to that. And the way they've stepped up now is more nuanced than perhaps the news reports are giving us an indication of. So, with that in mind, let me sort of, again, I invite debate and discussion on this. I think there was an enormous amount of detailed discussion about Chinese governance, which committees were formed, which political organs were taking responsibility. And a lot of that was in immediately after Tiananmen Square and in the 1990s. And I'll be quite honest with you, I have no expectation. You guys are going to need to commit that to memory. It's historically interesting, but it is not enormously relevant now in terms of Chinese policy. But given that context, it does point out the most important thematic difference between the United States and China in terms of their approach to climate policy, which is, by the way, I've handed out, that's the INDC for China. So that's what they're actually committing to the United Nations, what they intend to do. I left out the portion in Mandarin, so that's the English translation at the back. The yes, so, and it was actually submitted just a couple weeks ago. And the tabbed portion is what the actual numerical commitments are by China. And you'll see that they actually parallel the statements that were made in the joint statement as well as the presidential statements made last month. The difference between China and the United States is the United States views climate change as an environmental issue predominantly with impacts on the energy. The Clean Power Plan is from EPA and not FERC, and there's a reason for that. The Chinese approach flips that. China views climate change now as a matter of national security, energy policy, and independence from foreign supplies of petroleum. That colors their approach to climate change. As opposed to us, where we are focused most on total tonnage of greenhouse gas emissions, for China, the emphasis has been on the intensity of emissions related to economic growth, as well as ways to leapfrog ahead to less carbon-intensive technologies that still allow energy independence. So, as a result, they're very focused on reducing energy consumption. Not as much because of the climate footprint, but just because it has collateral consequences important for their sovereign interest. Now, that means if you look at their five-year plan, which the next one's coming out next year, so we're a few years behind in the curve right now, but the current five-year plan is focused on reductions of around 16 to 17% in carbon intensity in terms of production of economic units. Having said that, we need to give credit where credit's due. China did sign the Kyoto Protocols. China did sign the Copenhagen Accords. China is submitting an INDC with substantial numerical commitments that other developing nations are not. So their approach, which we might argue with in terms of the actual numerical absolute reductions it accomplishes, given their economic growth, their need to raise their population out of poverty, and its unquestioned success in terms of striking some balances, perhaps does justify giving it sort of towards the middle of our spectrum as opposed to Canada. Anyway, now I'm sort of veering into giving you my opinion. Let's focus on what their policy is. The key thing to take away is, as opposed to Canada and the United States, which have to navigate a political process for adoption of national legislation and state legislation subject to multiple layers of governance review and dispute, China points a finger and it can get done. It's a simplification. There's some economic autonomy of local governance, but nonetheless, its heavily centralized approach allows it to actually plan, dictate, control, and modulate the arc of its carbon emissions. So as a result, it has the capacity to refocus its industries. It has the capacity to say it is going to accomplish a switch to 40% of renewable energy in a certain period in the future, which we can't. Well, realistically, let's put it this way. While we might be able to do it as a matter of legal power, but it pours enormous political and constitutional challenges if we try to do that in the United States. So China surprisingly has, after being viewed, frankly, as a bad actor for over a decade, has some stuff going now. And Ronnie, I think, even though I've given you a hard time based on your brave volunteering of a position, I think you've captured the essence of it, which is China does have a governance system and national legislation that gives it the capacity to do it, has made some commitments which may be accomplishable, if that's a word, although there's some skepticism as to whether or not they'll actually do it. Yeah, the only problem is those goals themselves prepackage contained emissions that could keep us from getting to 2 degrees centigrade. All right, so I've kind of rambled on. Any questions or thoughts about China at this point? Let me throw something out that's not in the book then. This is all climate change discussion. China has actually implemented last year a radical revamping of its environmental law, a national domestic environmental law, in part driven by strong domestic discontent about unacceptable levels of pollution attributed to economic development. Has anyone here been in Beijing recently?
A couple years ago.
Yeah, it was probably still the same way now. What was your reaction on getting off the plane in Beijing?
Coughing.
Yeah, it's astonishing.
It's terrible.
If you were there about the same time as me, what year were you there?
Last I was there was probably right after the Olympics, probably the year after.
So I was probably there about the same time, maybe a little bit before you. I'm not exaggerating. And I think sometimes you hear this so much it's easy to devalue it. But visibility was never more than 100 yards, ever. It looked like China was perpetually in a misty fog that was dry, no water. It was a sort of thing where I'd like to think I'm fairly even-handed and even-keeled about it, that I was genuinely concerned if I was staying in Beijing for another week that it was going to have some serious impacts on my health. And people live there for years. Yeah.
My brother lived there for a year.
And what, did he do okay? Or?
Yeah, he's fine now, but it was bad for him.
Okay. Bottom line is that exact unitary political framework I've talked about is the theory is that the new Chinese National Environmental Policy Act is going to have the capacity to change that. Whether or not it'll actually be enforced because of the economic dislocation it may cause is an open question though. So any questions about China or Canada at this point before we go on to Brazil? Okay. Brazil is an odd case here because it has the broadest range between bad actor and good actor. So, Nick, you argued in favor of Brazil. Any particular reason why what Brazil's doing, you think, in your mind?
I just think their efforts to cut down on deforestation in the past, like, 15 or 20 years has been pretty great. And I think I read a statistic that they've actually cut their emissions more than, I think, I don't know if any other country or most countries their size, like more than anybody in the past 20 years, just because of how much they've cut down on deforestation.
So in terms of percentage reduction, absolute.
And I think that while internationally sometimes they can seem like a bad actor because they don't want to make commitments and stuff, that domestically they are doing a lot in terms of the deforestation, which is kind of their main driver for greenhouse gases and climate change.
All right, so who would like to argue that Brazil is an environmental villain at this point? Let me sort of offer a few thoughts. If someone were to hire me to make the case, first of all, it's worth making an important theoretical stop before we get any much further down the road. We have changed gear in a deep and fundamental way. When we talk about China, when we talk about Canada, we're talking about nations whose emissions profile is rooted almost overwhelmingly in stationary sources, on energy production, and on transportation. Things coming out of tailpipe or a smokestack. The situation with Brazil is fundamentally different in that the overwhelming majority of its greenhouse gas emissions are indirect due to deforestation. Both unlocking the carbon in the forest that's felled, as well as losing the uptake of carbon from areas that's been converted to cropland. So as a result, we're talking about how do you give credit for, calculate, and weigh changes in use of land that have carbon dioxide impacts, even if you can't measure or control them directly. Which you're saying in terms of Brazil, their emissions reductions are based in the fact that they've reduced the rate of loss of rainforest, which means that their rate of surrogate greenhouse gas emissions is not going up as fast. Notice I've phrased that in very intentionally lukewarm language. Yeah. The flip side of it is their deforestation is still occurring despite their efforts to stop it. The flip side of that as well is that their total absolute emissions as measured through deforestation are also increasing. So, you know, I want to be credit where the credit's due. You're absolutely right. Let's not forget, Brazil has half of the world's remaining temperate rainforest, tropical rainforest, excuse me. Brazil, as a result, has to wrestle with the fact that its emissions, 75% of them are from deforestation. It's just hard. You can't, by definition, most of that deforestation is illegal or obtained by fraud. So it's not a system where they're failing to issue permits or they're failing to have the political courage to set a limit. The question is being able to enforce a limit they politically agreed to. They've had some notable success, and Nick, you're absolutely correct, in using, interesting enough, satellite imagery tracing to identify in almost real time when illegal logging is occurring. They've been very effective in terms of enforcing existing domestic law obligations to control deforestation. In particular, there's a requirement that owners of land in Brazil that is covered with tropical rainforest must maintain at least 80% of that coverage during their period of ownership of the land. And they've gotten very good about finding ways to identify owners who are using more of their land than they should in causing deforestation. Bottom line, though, is they're still losing about half the land area of New Jersey every year. So intent, process versus results, Brazil does kind of deserve a little bit of a smear across the spectrum rather than a fixed point, perhaps. Let's talk a little bit about actually how they've got it set up. Number one, Brazil, like Canada, is like the United States, is a representational democracy. It also must deal with accounting for 27 different states in a federal district. So as a result, there's that same need to navigate conflicting multipolar political interests in crafting a domestic climate change policy and law. Second as well, they are developing, and while they're growing, they're not as well developed as arguably China in terms of total economic output. And they have a substantial need to continue to raise a large impoverished class to a middle class status. So they're definitely a developing nation. If we had our sort of spectrum with India, with China at the top and India a little bit lower down, Brazil's squarely somewhere right in there. That means that under Kyoto, under UNFCCC, they do not have binding emissions limitations expectations. They benefit from the common but differentiated responsibility doctrine. So here's what they have done to translate those factors into law. And let's sort of make sure how we peg the sufficiency of that response. By the way, before I forget, here's their IMDC, which is fascinating. It's not often you get a national government giving you a capsule summary of their law for you. Basically, they already have a national law that establishes a climate change target. And essentially, that target is up to 38% reductions in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. Here's the catch, that goal is voluntary. They do make binding legal commitments to combat deforestation. That commitment is embodied in terms of legal restrictions on land use rather than total greenhouse gas emissions. That land use is couched in terms of getting permits for approval for development of land and maintaining an 80% canopy cover. The question has always been effective enforcement, and that enforcement is getting better. There's actually been some interesting work done with drones. That's what the book describes in terms of national domestic legislation. Let me add another layer to that, which is that the Brazilian Constitution guarantees a right to a clean environment. The Brazilian Supreme Court has actually been very activist in translating that generalized constitutional commitment into specific enforcement activity. Justice Antony Benjamin has actually been probably the most active environmental scholar, certainly in South America, but arguably in the world, in terms of pushing for constitutional environmental rights translated into domestic obligations, including cases specifically targeting deforestation policies as violation of Brazilian constitutional rights. Judges in Brazil have a dual role where they are not only deciders but also prosecutors. So they have the ability to independently initiate actions and bring these issues of constitutional violations before the court. So it's not just the statute. As opposed to China, where judicial precedent by definition is relatively limited, if non-existent. In Brazil, the judiciary is a valuable and important role player in addition to the legislature. So with that, I'll pause. Any questions before we talk about what probably matters most to Brazil internationally as a result? We've talked about the concept before, but REDD, Red Plus, and I'll pause here. Who wants to earn bonus points? What does RED stand for? Albert?
I can't tell you what the acronym is.
Oh, so close.
Reduction of emissions? I don't know. It's definitely reducing emissions by reducing deforestation.
Exactly. Reduction of emissions from deforestation, and I forget what the second D stands for, development perhaps. It is a concept where essentially the same flexibility mechanisms we've discussed in Kyoto are applied to deforestation. By granting emission reduction credits that are bankable and tradable, it allows reforestation or projects to protect areas from deforestation to actually generate a monetizable environmental benefit that encourages people to invest in saving forests. essentially it's the same type of transfer mechanism for wealth and technology the CDM provides for other types of traditional emission reductions. It is very controversial, very hard to do. It is difficult to calculate what your net carbon savings is from rainforest, given the fact that the permanence of the carbon reduction from the uptake of CO2 is variable. It's also subject to manipulation to some extent, but the key thing is out of the Durban platform, there was an agreement on a REDD+ framework where there is now within the UNFCCC an intellectual guideline as to how nations like Brazil can set up and get credit for their deforestation activities. And those mechanisms assure that they can sell those benefits to international markets. So it's an enormous step forward. You could make arguments as to whether it's more important in terms of domestic legislation and enforcement or the REDD+, but my sense is together they make an enormous difference. If I had to sort of tip my hand and tell you where I would put Brazil in the spectrum, I kind of lean towards Nick. They have enormous challenges. They don't have the same resources that others like us might have to respond to it, but they have been surprisingly proactive in going after violators, reducing deforestation, coming up with national legislation and constitutional guarantees, and participating in international frameworks that let them encourage investment in sustainable practices. They are not at the EU end. They still have enormous battles to fight in terms of the development of their beef industry, development of palm oil, development of soybean, that and illegal logging practices, all of which contribute to make it very difficult to protect the forest against erosion at the edges. But they're much better than they used to be. Pausing. Any questions before I skip to India at the end? All right. Then, before I forget, and here is the INDC for India. Of all the ones we've distributed so far, it is the thickest. It is arguably the most ambitious. Let me just say generally, India has become the new China. China took the leading role in the Group of 77, opposing restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions by developing nations. India has taken that role from China as China has become more proactive in dealing with the greenhouse gas emissions. So that kind of leaves an interesting issue then. They have recently committed to reducing their intensity of their greenhouse gas emissions in a host of investment vehicles for renewable energy, which will drastically increase the amount that they're going to use. Before I sort of get to the punchline on those, let me add a few things. Number one, China. We're talking about China so much. India's legal system, for those of you who've had a chance to explore it, it's fascinating. Bottom line is it is British jurisprudence. Common law system, all proceedings in English, courts divided in the same structure that we would see in our federal court system with district courts, high courts, and then the Indian Supreme Court. The difference is twofold. One, the Indian Supreme Court has found implicit in Article 21 of the Indian Constitution a constitutional right to a clean environment, which is enforceable. Number two, India has a vehicle called public interest litigation, which essentially is a class action citizen suit on steroids. Essentially, any individual, whether or not they have individualized standing, has the capacity to bring a lawsuit in defense of constitutional rights held by large populations. As a result, there are very sophisticated and very powerful advocates who specialize in bringing public interest litigation designed to reshape Indian society. PIL litigation has done everything from forcing all taxis and bus transit in Delhi switch to natural gas. They have shut down chemical plants and tanneries up and down the Ganges River. They have resulted in the forced preservation of large swaths of jungle and forests to the northeast regions of India, all by individuals who live in Delhi who are basically are professional environmental advocates. Therefore, it's a little interesting that no one has brought a case dealing with climate change. It's kind of the sleeping giant. Considering that India is poised to become the leading greenhouse gas emitter and overtake China in the space of a decade, the capacity of the judicial system to be able to respond and bring the national government to a different policy perspective is going to be extremely important. It's not impossible. So I've talked about in class before, we've had court judgments in the Netherlands and Pakistan during this semester, where a court has ruled that both of those national governments has failed to comply with international law obligations to control greenhouse gas emissions and ordered the national governments to come up with a national policy. So India is poised for an interesting test case. The other interesting factor is that that lawsuit would not be in the Indian Supreme Court. The Indian Supreme Court recently, let me rephrase that, the Indian Parliament recently passed legislation that created a unique new body called the National Green Tribunal, which is India's Supreme Court for the environment. As a result, that public interest litigation for climate change would go before a body that consists of half judges, all of them former Indian Supreme Court judges, and half engineers, not lawyers. Every hearing, every panel of the judge, of the decision makers would be split, half lawyers, half engineers. And all PIL litigation would, as a result, come before a quasi-judicial body, which is going to be very sophisticated in terms of the technical challenges. And that court, that tribunal, has not been shy. They are on the verge of ordering the Indian government to effectively... I hear this is just me talking. I can't tell you I have any inside track. Please do not attribute this to anybody publicly, but the National Green Tribunal is agitating very effectively to force India to clean up the primary river running through Delhi, the Yamuna River, which has been intractable political challenge. The court basically is just saying it's a violation of the Constitution, it must be done. So all long way of saying India has a judicial and legislative heritage that makes it perhaps susceptible to the influence of independent third parties through lawsuits to compel change. That's probably several years away. Those of you who are interested, though, let me know. I've often thought there just needs to be there's a real opportunity there for an NGO to step up and play a perhaps critical role in helping that happen. In the meantime, India has committed to an extraordinary set of ambitious goals for increasing renewable energy, reducing carbon intensity of economic development. Right now, Albert's looking through the INDC for India, and it's about 44 pages long, maybe more.
38.
38, sorry. And it's not fluff. There's some fluff in there. You know, there is enough in the earth to supply every man's need, but not to support every man's greed. I've heard that four different times in the last conference I went to. Bottom line, though, is that, and here's what's buried in the last couple of pages, this enormously ambitious agenda is conditional. India is only committing to do it on a national domestic level if they receive financial support that enables them to do it. Rough preliminary calculations, the price tag is $2.5 trillion. Which is larger than the GDP of India. So that's over a period of 15 years, but nonetheless, it's an enormous number. So read carefully there. It's a very inspirational document, but $100 billion, even if it all went to India, would barely dent it. And so it's the prospects of actual implementation are a little dim. So. That's the spectrum. That's sort of what other nations are doing. That gives you some benchmark to take a look at what the United States is currently doing. And hopefully it'll make you feel perhaps a little bit warmer inside in terms of just how proactive the United States has certainly been in the past 8 years.
Where would you put the U.S. on
that? Oh, that's not fair. How about this? Will you give me license to change my mind as the course of the semester goes along? just right now at the top of my head. And by the way, any of you can disagree with me, and if you persuade me to your point of view, I'll be glad to offer up a very nice bottle of scotch. But bottom line is this, it's not the United States. If you look at the White House and executive policy, we're probably getting closer to the EU these days. The mere promulgation of the Clean Power Plan is an enormous step forward. Despite its failure, the tailoring rule, which we'll talk about, as well as what's left of the back determinations after the Supreme Court struck down the tailoring rule, enormous steps forward. We are seeing the real prospect of significant changes in our greenhouse gas profiles. Having said that, Congress is closer towards India on this one. There's, and I don't mean to be pessimistic, like we said, Lindsey Graham actually cracked the climate facade of the Republican Party, but I think John Boehner's resignation is an enormously discouraging sign for the prospects of reasonable climate policy out of Congress. And I think I'm not speaking politically there, in terms of reasonable defined as responsive to majority scientific consensus and international consensus. I don't say we need to do everything that's being proposed by Greenpeace to be a good actor, but there's a fair argument to be made that the congressional reluctance to even acknowledge the existence of climate change is not what I would call a realistic, a policy reflective of reality. all along way of saying, I would put the United States a little bit of the smear itself, certainly based on what we've actually accomplished in the executive branch and what we're doing at the state levels, we're probably certainly to the left of Canada, doing pretty well. In terms of actually being able to ratify a treaty and to pass a national climate change act, we're far to the right of Brazil and China and getting close to India. And I think that's probably unfair to India, because India has done a lot nationally to the extent that they have less resources. We have the capacity to do more, arguably. But by the way, like I said, what you just heard is just my opinion. Please don't type that down, because it doesn't really mean anything other than just my opinion. I'd be curious if you guys disagree or have a different perspective as we wrap up the class. I am encouraged by the things we're about to study. I really am. I am also, I think, realistic that a lot of things that are currently on the table are not going to survive the next 3 years. And if we have a change of administration, that percentage of fatality is going to go up. So, is that a long, long answer, Spencer?
No, that was great.
Okay. Anything else you guys like to talk about before we turn off the recorder, go off the record? Okay. All right. Then, two things. Number one, we are going to the United States going forward next week. We're going to get much more into the weeds in terms of statutory and regulatory policy, because I think it's appropriate now. So be prepared. We will be focusing on specific language of permits and rules and regulations. I'll try and provide examples for us to have in class. Number two, I will be in Washington next week for a meeting with the EPA General Counsel on the Clean Power Plan. So if you all have anything that you would like for me to ask him as a surrogate, I'm glad to do it if I have the opportunity. But all I ask is that you email me, copy the rest of the class. If one question bubbles to the top by a claim and consensus, let me know, and I'll be glad to sort of take a shot at it. It's a fairly small meeting, so hopefully we'll have a chance to go off the record a little bit. And I think other than that, enjoy the weekend. Okay? All right. Thanks.